few minutes later, and I will call the first case, which is 97-2336 CR State v. Love. Maureen McGlynn Flanagan argues for the state, Mr. Attorney General. Ms. Flanagan.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am, as you said, Maureen McGlynn Flanagan. I'm an assistant attorney general. I am representing the state, which is the petitioner in this review proceeding. The general issue that is presented to this court in this case is, at least in this state, a matter that has not been addressed in any of the existing precedents. So it is a case of first impression under Wisconsin law, although we contend not under federal, both Circuit Court of Appeals and Supreme Court precedent. And that issue is, what legal standard governs the disposition of ineffective assistance of counsel claims caused by an attorney's successive representation of opposing parties during the course of the same or a substantially related case when the apparent conflict is not timely raised in the trial court prior to judgment and sentencing? In the argument today, I want to address basically two points. One, I want to reiterate the state's primary position, argued at length in both its brief in chief and the reply brief, that the legal standard governing conflict claims timely brought in to the trial court's attention is different than the standard which governs ineffective assistance of counsel conflict claims, which by definition are not timely raised. The second point I would like to discuss is that I would like to clarify the state's position regarding whether this court should, in its supervisory power, adopt a prophylactic rule governing serial representation conflict of interest claims. And I would like to suggest, based on this court's decisions in State v. Miller and State v. Kay, what the nature of such a rule should be. Basically, if the court wishes to adopt a supervisory rule, we strongly believe that the rules set forth in Kay and Miller are easily adapted to the serial representation conflict. I've just been using the term serial and multiple representation. By those terms, I mean to distinguish, as we do in the briefs, between most of the conflict of interest claims that have come before the courts in this jurisdiction and others, which involve multiple representation, essentially at the same time, of clients who may have differing interests in a particular litigation. And the serial representation conflict refers basically to an attorney who represents one side initially in the course of litigation and then subsequently in either that same case or a substantially related case represents a party adverse to the initial client.
Let me ask you, and I understand your arguments, but why wouldn't a bright-line rule, we're talking about not only the conflict, but the appearance of conflict, whether it's multiple or serial, why wouldn't that be a good standard for this court to use? I know there are some problems with perhaps it'll be inconvenient to the state, et cetera, but isn't that just a... Then we'd have one rule, that would be it, and I think you're talking about when you find out whether you knew beforehand or whether this is something you can lay in the weeds, but ultimately, wouldn't it be easier just to have that rule and that would be it in this thing?
Well, I think the basic problem is that a bright line rule is not self-defining. And in fact, the court already has rules which govern this situation. Specifically, Supreme Court Rule 20, 1.9, conflict of interest involving a former client. And in addition...
Counsel, we can't hear you because your papers are covering up the microphone.
Sorry. In addition, the concept of conflict of interest is generally defined in the Supreme Court Rule 20.17. And those rules provide, are consistent with the law, that when a conflict claim is raised to the trial court's attention, that the trial court has to, as this court said in Kay and Miller, determine whether there is an actual conflict of interest, which may potentially affect the other party adversely, and must make a determination. But these rules are, in fact, prophylactic rules. They set the standard, and I think they've been working very well. Certainly in my experience, handling many criminal appeals cases, conflict claims are routinely raised in the trial court, and the trial courts dispose of them. And they rarely get raised on appeal.
Counsel, it seems to me this case has at least two variables. One is serial representation versus multiple representation. And the other is raising it at trial and then raising it after conviction. Right?
Okay. I think I agree with you that there is a major distinction or a variable between whether the claim is raised at trial or in a timely fashion. In this case, it would have been at the sentencing hearing.
Yeah.
Or whether it's raised after judgment. The other variable that you identified, serial versus multiple representation, I frankly do not see any principal distinction in policy, in the law, certainly not in the Supreme Court case law and the developing federal precedent, to distinguish between serial representation and multiple representation of differing clients. Certainly the defendant has never identified any beyond saying, we think it's really different. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court said. The Court of Appeals said. We say it's different, but they never identify what that critical distinction is.
Counsel, at page 17 in your brief, focusing on that very argument that you're making, you say, however, distinguishing serial representation cases from multiple representation cases on the basis of potential detriment to the particular defendant has no necessary basis in fact, comma, at least when the defendant is the successor rather than the original client. Do you concede there is a distinguishing characteristic with regard to a potential detriment to the defendant if the defendant is the original rather than the successor client?
Well, I think there are obvious differences in fact, and given the dynamic of the kind of representation that you're involved, that it's reasonable to infer differing pressures on the attorney, which may create a conflict. But I don't agree that that this is a distinction that has meaning for setting what the legal standard should be. I think it would be much easier to resolve a conflict of interest claim which involves, in this case, a an attorney who previously represented the individual defendant and then and had his confidence and knowledge of privilege information and so forth and then became a prosecutor. And
if that were the facts in this case, how would your argument be different? If the representation of the defendant had been the original representation rather than the successive.
Well, I think my bottom line analysis of whether there is a conflict of interest here which necessitates reversal would be different. I don't think, and we said that the analysis of the law, what legal standard governs, does not turn on the relative, you know, the abstract idea.
When you say your bottom line would be different, I'm not quite following. Are you saying that you wouldn't be here on appeal if this had been the representation of the original client rather than the successive client?
By bottom line, I mean when you get down to the facts of this case, I know that I would analyze differently the issue of whether there was an actual conflict and whether there was adverse impact shown on the client. I think that it's reasonable to infer, and the record would show, that there are differing contexts. But I don't see and I don't believe the Court of Appeals has elucidated any meaningful distinction between those positions of the parties for purposes of setting the legal standard itself.
Well, what about the legal standard? If you're looking at SCR at, what is it, 20.1.9 or something like that, if I have it, yes, 20.1.9 sub A, that just deals with, a literal reading of sub A, just deals with the protection of the original client and not the successive client. It says, a lawyer who has formally represented a client in a matter shall not represent another person in the same or a substantially related matter in which that person's interests are materially adverse to the interests of the former client unless the former client consents in writing after consultation.
Well, if you're asking whether I could have made an argument that there wasn't a violation of SCR 20.19, I would have to say that I probably could have made that argument. But in fact, the trial court decision seemed to turn on a very fine reading of this rule, which the trial court concluded that the state was not a person and therefore wasn't a party with adverse interests, which I think is just a very narrow and unrealistic reading of the rule. Certainly, this rule is designed, as the court recognized in Miller and Kay and other cases, to deal with the situation where the trial court becomes aware of it at the time it's raised. And if you read 20.17, which is cross-referenced in the comments to 20.19, that defines what conflict of interest means, and it's much more general, and I don't think it's restricted to the precise positions of the party. So I think you have to read those two rules together, and in that context, I'm simply not willing to advance the argument that there's a meaningful distinction for purposes of this case between whether the prosecutor formerly represented the defendant or whether the defendant's attorney was in an opposite position. I think that as I've said, I think that the same legal standards govern the facts, however, maybe quite different. But it's clear that the obvious intent.
I want to not ask it if it's unfair, but I did ask it, and if you're able to answer it, I would like an answer. That is, in this case, if the representation of the defendant had been the original representation rather than the successive representation, would you be here?
Well, I'll have to speculate if you really want to answer that question. If in the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals had said, yes, we agree with you, the legal standard is the same post-judgment as in Kyler and the federal cases, and therefore the state loses because we think there's no actual conflict, we wouldn't be here for two reasons. One, we wouldn't be adversely, we would not want to take a petition for review on the limited facts of this case. And two, because our primary goal, which is achieving clarity and rationality in the law, would have been achieved.
Maybe I'm not making myself clear. Let me, if everything was the same, if the Court of Appeals rationale was, the only thing that was changed was that the attorney represented the defendant at the initial sentencing, and then and was part of the public defender's office, and then joined the DA's office for the successive sentencing. But the dispositions were all the same. Make any difference?
Well, as I've said, I thought I said several times, the facts would make a big difference. I think if the trial court were faced with that fact, the trial court would surely know that the defendant had undoubtedly divulged confidential information to that particular attorney about his case and his personality and his background that would be almost impossible to separate out from his subsequent representation of the state as a prosecutor in the same or said substantially related case. So I don't think it would have, you know, if that were the fact situation, I don't think it would have ripened into a Supreme Court case.
Well, let's look at the standard. This is a standard for post-conviction, or at least post-sentencing, right? And the standard you want is that the defendant must prove by clear and convincing evidence, I'm reading from the conclusion of your brief, that an actual conflict of interest, now, was there an actual conflict of interest in this case, in your view?
In my view, there was no actual conflict of interest based on the analysis I've set forth in my brief. There was an apparent conflict of interest, although it wasn't apparent to anybody who was in there in the trial court at the time, not at any rate anybody who said anything on the record. But I don't believe there was an actual conflict because in this case, the assistant DA's, Lisowski's role at the sentencing, as the record reflects, was she picked the file up that morning, she asked for recess to read the pre-sentence and read the state's file, and she then presented an argument totally consistent with defendant's position because there had been a negotiated joint disposition recommended. That was that the defendant should be placed on probation in spite of his long prior record and in spite of the fact that the pre-sentence report recommended a stiffer sanction based on the intensive sanctions program. So there was no adverse interest at the sentencing. When she then later...
But now I think you're confusing the two. I read your request as being a two-part request. I read Kyler as being two parts. First of all, that there's an actual conflict. Secondly, that it adversely affected her performance.
Yeah.
And you were on... In answer to the Chief's question, you were saying that there was no actual conflict of interest, correct?
That's right.
But then you used the word adversely. We're not at that stage yet. At least I was not at that stage in my own mind trying to follow your argument.
Okay, well maybe I, you know, stated it too broadly.
Were you moving on to the adverse?
No, I wasn't meaning to.
You don't have to have an adverse impact in order to have an actual conflict, do you?
Well, to have an actual conflict, you have to have factual circumstances that lead one to conclude there is an actual conflict. And
so whether or not it adversely affected the performance,
has nothing to do with whether or not there is an actual conflict. Here we've got an attorney who represented the other side in another case. I mean, you can prevail on either one, it seems to me. You don't care which one you prevail on. You could say, well, there was no actual conflict, but if there was an actual conflict, it didn't adversely affect the performance. But it seems to me that you're blending the two.
Well,
I was somewhat surprised when you answered the chief's question. I thought you were going to concede, maybe, now during this argument, although you've been conceding in your brief, that there was an actual conflict of interest.
No, I don't believe there was. Not at the time of the original sentencing. Now, when...
And why was there no actual conflict of interest?
At the original sentencing, there was not any actual conflict of interest because the defendant and the state took exactly the same position with regard to the issue before the court, which was what was the proper disposition of the case. Now, when you then move to the second point about adverse impact, then you have to look at the factual circumstances.
But are you saying that a lawyer can get around a conflict of interest? Forgetting for the moment whether it adversely affected performance. But a lawyer can get around the concerns about conflict of interest by simply representing the defendant's side, even though he may have represented the state's side?
No, I don't mean anything so broad at all. As the cases under ineffective assistance of counsel and this court's cases under the rules require, there has to be an analysis of the particular facts. You don't just put some sort of label like per se conflict on something because it doesn't tell you anything. Point would be better illustrated. I'm sorry.
It does tell you something if, in fact, there's no actual conflict. If Ms. Laskowski, or excuse me if I didn't pronounce her name correctly, if she didn't represent the state, then there's no actual conflict of interest. So then it becomes very meaningful. You don't even have to determine whether or not there was any adverse consequences to the defendant because ipso facto, there was no conflict.
Well, in this case, the facts are very limited. She was not the charging attorney. She had not negotiated the plea agreement. She had not handled any other matters in this case except a prior adjournment. She literally had no substantive role in carrying forward the prosecution. Now, if you change those variables, you get a different fact situation. So my position that there's no actual conflict at the time of the original sentencing is based on the facts as they were at that time. Now, if you get to the later sentencing, about close to 2 years later, after defendant's probation was revoked, she comes in and she appears on behalf of the defendant. Now, at that point, there certainly appears to be an actual conflict. So then, at that point, you, I think, in this case, need to go on to whether or not there was an adverse impact on the defendant's representation. And on that point, neither the Court of Appeals nor the defendant has ever identified, as this court and other courts have in many other cases, what that adverse effect might be. There's no argument anybody has pointed to that Laskowski failed to raise. There's no tactical choices that she made that would be affected. I think the Court of Appeals implicitly, though not expressly, accepted that there was no actual conflict and that there was no adverse impact.
What's the matter with the Court of Appeals decision? It says it's narrow. It affects post-conviction where the state representative now represents the defendant at a second proceeding. What's the matter with that?
Well,
it's a bright line, simple test, and it can't happen that many times. I mean, multiple representation does happen a lot. But zero representation, I can't believe there's so much interchange between defense and prosecution.
It's my understanding that in particular counties, it may well happen, as it did in this case, where you have a court that has one attorney, one district attorney assigned to it throughout the day, and that attorney has to represent the state in every matter that every criminal matter that comes up that day. And, you know, unless that attorney is actually the charging counsel, they, for routine appearances, certainly they have no particular knowledge of the case. For example, in this case, Lisowski, prior to the initial sentencing, had asked for an adjournment. I believe this was a joint recommendation that the parties be given additional time to prepare for sentencing because a pre-sentence report had not been submitted. Now, I can't see any distinction between that request for an adjournment in terms of the disposition of this case based on the Court of Appeals rule and whether she took a more substantive role at the subsequent sentencing. Sorry, my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Flanagan. You have some time for rebuttal. Representing the defendant is Philip J. Bream.
I am attorney Philip Bream, and I practice out of Janesville, Wisconsin. I represent the defendant, Michael Love. The court knows the facts of this case, and there's a single well-defined issue before the court. My position is identical to the position of the Court of Appeals, and that decision was a unanimous three-judge panel. I take the position that when Attorney Lisowski represented the defendant at sentencing after revocation, after previously representing the state in the same case, an impermissible conflict of interest occurred, which justifies a resentencing in this case, even in the absence of a showing of prejudice. I take the position that serial representations should never be allowed in criminal cases, regardless of who is represented first. I think the appearance of impropriety which occurs in these situations is pervasive and destructive to the system as a whole.
Well, so I assume you're talking about an assistant DA that actually was involved in the case rather than just be a member of the DA's office.
That's correct. I would draw a distinction between the district attorney being in the office as opposed to actually appearing on the case.
So with that, and this is the line that I find a little difficult. So if someone they have a hypothetically a 10-person office and someone calls up the judge and as a substitute says, can I get an adjournment? That's all they do. But they are representing your client and getting an adjournment. Under the rule I think you're proposing, the bright line rule, that would take that person out of that case, even if it was as minor as that type of telephone call. Right or wrong?
I mean, you are correct on that.
Correct.
In this particular case, as the court knows, Ms. Lisowski appeared on behalf of the state at original sentencing, which is obviously a very important appearance. Sure. But I think the same logic would apply if the attorney in question, Ms. Lisowski, merely appeared briefly before the court on behalf of the state.
Yeah. Well, and there wasn't even an appearance. This was just, where if there is any cutoff line, there isn't any. You're saying once you make a telephone call, you do anything, whether it's on a substantive or just a date change, you're out of the case.
I would draw the line at when that attorney participates in the court proceeding in some way. And if it is contacting the court clerk to change the scheduling, I think that's a fine line. And I would think under my rule that attorney probably would be disqualified.
Counsel, Mr. Bream, have you finished answering Justice Wilcox?
Yes.
I find the Kyler rule somewhat appealing. And I find the state's argument somewhat appealing also, that there is no distinction, really no real distinction, between serial and multiple representations. And I guess if you're going to prevail in my mind, you're going to have to give me a pretty good distinction and why they should be treated differently.
Well, I believe there is a distinction between multiple and serial representations.
I know there's a distinction, but why should they be treated differently?
in a multiple representation situation, co-defendants who are represented by the same attorney stand to gain from the representation by a single attorney. They can stand to have a stronger defense because that single attorney is going to present a consistent defense rather than one that potentially would occur where you have two defense counsel and things they do may impact on the other co-defendant. But if some positive can come to that arrangement for the defendant and there's no cost to any other party, I think as a matter of public policy that multiple representations should be allowed. Then you have the serial representation where no positive utility can come. In a serial representation, the only benefit that can accrue to the second party is at the cost of the previous party. In this particular case, it's possible that when Attorney Lazowski appeared on behalf of the defendant at sentencing after revocation, she could have had previous access to confidential information that was in the control of the state. That, of course, is to the detriment of the state. But at the same time, in a serial representation, it's possible that as Mr. Love's attorney at sentencing after revocation, she may have hesitated to attack previous work that she had done in the district attorney's office. She may have also, as attorney for Mr. Love, had to eat something that she said in court on a previous occasion. And in fact, that happened in this case. At the original sentencing, when Ms. Lazowski appeared on behalf of the state, she told the court, and I'm going to paraphrase what she told the court, but she said, "Judge, I know what the pre-sentence report says, but place this man on probation. In the event his probation is ever revoked, though, Judge, you're going to have no choice but to send this person to prison and to send this person to prison for 10 years. Then we go 20 months later, and Ms. Lazowski is now appearing as defense counsel, and she has to make a statement as defense counsel that flies in the face of what she had said 20 months earlier. 5 years is now appropriate as a sentence after revocation, Judge. She had to say something that directly contradicted what she said previously as a defense or as a state's attorney." And I think in that respect, that's how a serial representation can be different.
But what you've said to me so far seems to be that with respect to multiple representations, there is potential gain for the defendant, but there is potential harm. In serial representations, you seem to have just said that there is some potential gain for the defendant, but there is some potential harm.
Right, but my position is that it's only at the cost of the previous party, and I think that goes back to appearances of impropriety and the damage that can be caused to the system if these types of arrangements are allowed. There is another difference between multiple and serial representations that I want to point out to the court, and that would be that in your typical multiple representation situation, everybody is aware of the representation. The trial court is aware. You have the defense attorney aware, the state's attorney is aware, and most importantly, the defendant himself or herself is aware. And if the system is functioning properly in a multiple representation situation, the trial court, under the state versus K decision, has an obligation to inquire of the defendant as to the risks and benefits of continuing in the multiple representation situation. The court will tell the defendant that not only are there benefits, that there's risk as well. And the court is supposed to require the defendant to waive the conflict on the record. Now, from time to time, down the road in cases, after that's been done, situations come up. Defense attorneys occasionally have to appear before the court for a joint sentencing of co-defendants. And that's the classic example where problems tend to arise. The defense attorney is put in a situation of having to decide which co-defendant is going to get the exhaust representation and which one is not. One of the co-defendants later may be dissatisfied, but if that co-defendant is dissatisfied, that co-defendant in that situation is going to have to show prejudice. How he or she was prejudiced as a result of the representation. And the reason why is fairly obvious, because that defendant was warned earlier of the risk of this type of issue coming up, and the defendant should not have his or her cake and eat it too. But the same mechanism is not available in the serial representation. In the serial representation, the colloquy does not take place between the trial court and the defendant. The defendant is not warned of the risks and benefits of having the same attorney represent the two co-defendants.
Counsel, could you clarify for me exactly what is meant by serial representation? In this case, Ms. Lazowski represented Mr. Love in a sexual assault, subsequent sexual assault matter, and I think a subsequent burglary matter.
Right, I believe it was a concurrent matter.
All right. Is that serial representation?
I believe that an argument could be made that that would be a serial representation as well by definition. I am not suggesting that the rule set forth by the Court of Appeals should be extended that broadly.
So you do not dispute the propriety of Ms. Lazowski representing Mr. Love at those subsequent felony charges, is that right?
Well, in the subsequent felony charges, I believe that Ms. Lazowski testified at the post-conviction hearing that she, in fact, had talked to the client about the issue and that the client had waived the issue.
How about at the probation revocation hearing? Is that serial representation?
Yes.
Is that inappropriate?
For Ms. Lazowski to represent the defendant at the probation revocation hearing? Yes. I would take the position that it is because she is representing both the state and the defendant in exactly the same case. And I draw a distinction there. And I believe the Court of Appeals has, since this decision came down in the Court of Appeals, drawn a distinction as well. I believe, there is the case of State versus Cobb, where a defendant was represented by a defense counsel. The defense counsel then became an attorney for the state and prosecuted the defendant on separate types of cases, well, a separate criminal case. I think that the Court of Appeals was correct, and I think that their decision in Cobb is totally consistent with their decision in this case.
Was there a waiver in Cobb?
In Cobb, there was a waiver, but I honestly don't believe that the waiver was a crucial fact in that case.
Mr. Brown, if I might, let me ask you, let's assume that this court likes the Tyler decision. We take the approach that the Seventh Circuit took in the Spreitzer case. What is the adverse effect that your client suffered as a result of the serial representation here?
Well, I think it's difficult for a defendant in my client's situation to prove up an adverse effect. To be able to show one is extremely difficult, and that's why it's my position that he should not have to do so in this very special situation, that when the same attorney represents both sides in the same case, that prejudice should be presumed.
So you can't prove up an adverse effect, is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that it gets to be much more difficult.
I understand.
Because all the evidence comes through Attorney Lazowski. Attorney Lazowski It's an uncomfortable situation to have to appear as a witness in a post-conviction motion. There is always going to be that self-preservation issue that comes about.
You raise a good point, counsel, that it's difficult to prove a negative, which is essentially what this standard puts upon you, I think.
Right.
But given, even with that difficulty, can you point to any adverse effect?
Well, the only adverse effect that I could point to would be what I mentioned earlier, that Ms. Lasowski was put in a situation where she, as attorney for the defendant, had to make a statement that was completely inconsistent with a statement she had made earlier. That being that, you know, earlier, judge, if she gets revoked, 10 years is the only possible sentence, and then later, 5 years is an appropriate sentence.
Now, did she remember that she had said that?
That particular question was not asked of her at the post-conviction motion. It's my position that that doesn't make any difference.
No, but it was generally that she didn't remember anything about the case, isn't that right? And the trial court held her credible.
Right.
So she apparently did not remember. So when she represented the defendant and now was asserting a different time, she did not know, if you accept the trial court, she didn't know that she had said something differently.
Right, but the fact that she said something and the judge perceived it on both occasions could have led to the judge that earlier statement may have had an effect on
it. That was my next point. Is this the same judge? And does the judge have the prior record in front of him?
I don't believe that the judge would have had the prior record in front of him at the time of sentencing after revocation.
And one assumes that the judge doesn't know that the state's attorney is now representing the defendant.
I take the position that regardless of whether the judge knew or Ms. Lasowski knew, that the very fact that it occurs is so insidious in this case. Even if the defendant and the court personnel were the only people at original sentencing and at sentencing after revocation, certainly the press would have the ability to report on the case, and you know, people hear what happens in court.
Mr. Brain, is there anything in the sentencing transcript to indicate that Ms. Lasowski did not vigorously represent the interests of her client at the second sentencing hearing? She didn't, in other words, argue in favor of what was appropriate for the defendant?
I cannot point to anything that Attorney Lasowski did as a defense attorney for the defendant which was inappropriate. But I guess my ultimate point comes back to how it looks to the general public and what it does to the system. I think if you ask members of the general public whether they would be in favor of this type of arrangement, the general public would, for the most part, be against it. And when it comes right down to it, there's very little to be said in favor of it.
When was the first time that Mr. Love knew that Ms. Lasowski had been an assistant district attorney in the same case?
I cannot answer that question because that question was never asked at the post-conviction motion hearing, and the judge did not consider that an important fact, as I recall. I honestly do not know the answer to that question.
Well, you certainly recognize the potential for sandbagging the state, don't you? I mean, Milwaukee County, here in Dane County, these district attorneys get these cases and they walk into court and then they look like a deck of cards and they just deal them off the top. I find it very credible to believe that a state's attorney would have no recollection a year, 2 years down the line that somehow they had represented the state against this particular defendant, whereas I find it quite... I would think that most defendants would forever remember the district attorney that prosecuted.
I agree that there is that possibility that defendants could use this type of conflict to sandbag the state and get an automatic reversal. But it presupposes a lot of things taking place. One is that nobody recognizes the conflict in the first place. And I think the state would have a mechanism available to it to protect itself from being taken advantage of in this situation. And that would be to take a few minutes to review the court file to see whether or not, in fact, that attorney had ever previously represented the state when that attorney appears at sentencing after revocation. Now, the fact that an attorney switches sides and becomes a defense attorney after being a prosecutor, I would think that that fact would be somewhat known in the community, and that in itself may send up a warning sign that perhaps in this particular case we better watch out, we better make sure there is no conflict, and from the state's perspective that should be done to avoid a reversal in this case. It's my position that serial representations just are not defendable at all. I believe that they place attorneys in situations where they will face unresolvable conflicts, that they will have to choose between which of their clients, the client they are now representing or their former client, will get the vigorous representation. And there's just too great of a risk to the institution of the criminal justice system.
But isn't that just what the trial judge, assuming that it's timely, determined that the trial judge or counsel would be able to determine these, quote, apparent risks? In other words, the risks of conflict, the risks of appearance. And I'll go back to my original question. When you have a bright line rule, the only thing, and I can really see the reason for it, I think it's in but the difficulty is when you get into these kind of questionable areas about whether you just, if you touch the file in a very cursory manner, is this enough? And you seem to indicate, yes, that the phone call, you know, even though it's on the edge, that would take the person out of it. And that's what I find, as Justice Pavlich is talking about, in these counties that have many, many district attorneys and they have files stacked up, etc., that it just seems to me that the rule has been that you have to find an apparent conflict, that the judge would be able to go into that, would be a better rule than just a bright line just eliminating once and for all. And I started out asking your opposing counsel that very question, but it's difficult for me to assume that a bright line rule would automatically be the best situation for this court to follow.
I believe that the Court of Appeals defined the bright line rule as the attorney when he or she represented the state actually appeared in court on the case.
So that's where you, that's the bar or the line that you would draw, would want this court to draw.
Well, I think you can still draw a bright line there and argue about whether it goes further than that. And if another case presents itself where that very issue comes up, perhaps that issue can be addressed at that time. I would take the position that in that situation where the attorney did something on the case that involved the court system, that the same rule should apply. Obviously, the state would probably take an opposite opinion on that.
Mr. Brehm, was Mr. Love's probation revoked?
Yes.
Did you indicated it was improper for Ms. Lazowski to represent Mr. Love in that proceeding, is that right?
Yes.
Is there some way to attack the revocation proceeding because of that alleged impropriety?
I believe that that action could be attacked in a post-conviction motion hearing. We chose not to do that in this particular case, and I believe the reason why that is because he deserved to be revoked under the circumstances. I understand that my position could lead to someone getting a new revocation hearing in the future or getting a new trial in the future. Realistically, the odds that it'll be a trial or a new revocation hearing is probably relatively small because of the practical pressures that prevent these types of arrangements coming about. Everyone has an interest in avoiding these serial representations. The trial court wants to protect the integrity of its convictions. The state does not want to have to deal with cases being reversed. The defense attorney does not want to face the unpleasant consequence of facing the Board of Professional Responsibility at some point. And defendants may not want to be put in a situation where their former attorney may still have allegiances to the state. So all of those pressures are going to work towards this issue not coming up all that often. What I'm asking the court to do in this case is not demolish the rules as they relate to conflicts. I am merely asking this court to, in this very unique situation, prejudice should be presumed. And that's all I'm asking the court to do. And I think because of the very unique problems that arise in this type of serial representation, there is cause to do exactly that.
What is the uniqueness of this situation?
That the same attorney represents both the state and the defendant in exactly the same case. I believe that that makes it a unique situation. Only in that situation do you have virtually guaranteed conflicts of loyalty. As an attorney for the state, Attorney Lazowski, when she appeared on November 1st of 1994 for the first time, at that time she had an undying loyalty to the state in this particular case. And that loyalty to the state does not stop when she leaves the state's attorney's office. It goes on forever. When she then picks up the defendant's case, she now has a loyalty to the defendant in the same case, and that's an eternal loyalty. And the chances of those loyalties clashes is heightened to the most it ever could be in a conflict situation. I believe that if the court upholds the decision of the Court of Appeals, the court will be sending a message to the general public that the rules of professional responsibility are not only out there to punish attorneys, but the rules are also out there to protect the integrity of the system. When a judge sentences a defendant to 10 years in prison, the judge is taking away an incredible amount of liberty of that person. That person has a right to have complete confidence in the result in the case. His family has a right to have complete confidence in what happened. The only way that's going to happen is to prohibit these types of representations.
What if in the future we had a case involving a defendant who knew but kept silent and then later raises it? Would you say that defendant would be deserving of being heard?
Well, under the position that I am taking, that should not make any difference.
Why shouldn't it make a difference? There's the defendant who knows that there's a conflict. The state can prove that he knew there was a conflict. Why should the courts sit back and allow that kind of silence to be used for the defendant's benefit? Why shouldn't we put a duty on the defendant, if we're going to go with you, to reveal the conflict when he becomes aware of it, or forever lose the right to raise it?
Well, practically that does happen, that defendants do raise them from time to time. But I think that presupposes that a defendant is going to be sophisticated enough to realize the risks and benefits of that type of arrangement. And I don't think you can make that presumption. Certainly it's going to be possible from time to time, but I think that that is possible from time to time in the system as it exists now. I can give the court an example. You have a defendant who is entering a plea as a habitual criminal, and the court forgets to ask him personally whether or not he is a habitual criminal. If he doesn't personally say he's a habitual criminal, the defendant may be allowed to come back into court at a later time and attack that habitual criminality allegation. Now, we can say that's not right, but there's a way to prevent that. The way to prevent it is to have the state ask the defendant on the record whether or not he or she is a habitual criminal. The state is given its protection in that situation, and the state in this situation also has the same protections available. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Flanagan.
I would like to just touch on a number of points that came up. First of all, the court raised a question Mr. Brown discussed or touched on several times. When did defendant know? He wasn't asked because he didn't testify in favor of his own motion at the post-conviction hearing. However, Ms. Losowski did testify, and she testified without contradiction that in general, and this appears at 47, page 7 and 8, the defendant was aware of my work for the DA at the time I represented him on a sexual assault. When the DA then sought to ask her about, clearly about what did he know about this case, the defendant objected, saying that we're just seeking a bright line rule here. It's a per se situation. You don't need to know the facts. And the trial court accepted that. So the reason we don't know, either from Losowski or from the defendant, is the defendant did not want the court to know. He certainly made no effort to let the court know of his concern, if there was one, about the conflict. The most reasonable inference from Ms. Losowski's testimony is that the defendant was aware that she had appeared on behalf of the state previously and that he didn't have any objection to it. But she said that she just honestly did not remember her representation at sentencing in this case and had not specifically asked him about that. And I think that illustrates the point that I didn't elucidate very clearly during my initial argument, which is that these cases involving serial representation, which Mr. Brown describes as so terribly unique, are not unique in the sense that in most conflict cases, especially where there's any really substantial conflict which arises, everybody has an interest in getting it clarified on the record, determining if there is a waiver, and if even if there is a waiver, whether public policy would support that waiver, even in the face of a conflict, as this court said in Miller. But the fact is, these cases come up where everybody forgets.
Counsel, let's take that Spreitzer case that you've cited several times in your brief. That was a case where they didn't forget. If I recall the facts of this case, and I took a quick look again, that there you had first-degree murder case, and there was an attorney that was in the public defender's office, Pete Dockery, and Pete was involved a bit in the charging decision in the district attorney's office. Goes to the public defender's office, and there's a new attorney there. The existing public defender who had represented the defendant was going to be leaving, and they needed someone to come and make a quick appearance, and the existing public defender said, well, I've got this young guy, Pete Dockery, in my office, but I don't think the state would want him to appear because he at one time was in the state's employ. And the state says, yeah, we wouldn't want him to appear. The state would object to that. And then the court says, yeah, I wouldn't have him appear at, I would, I would have him withdraw from the case anyway based upon that information, that he had been informed that he had been involved in the charging decision. The case unfolds. Dockery doesn't appear at all. A couple years later, lo and behold, he becomes the head public defender. His name's on the letterhead. And that was the serial representation. He didn't make any appearance. His name was on the letterhead when someone else made an appearance, right? Is that correct?
Well, I don't know. Jim Doyle is the attorney of record for the state in this case. Now, he hasn't personally come into court, but it seems to me that when his name is put on pleadings that are filed in court, that he appears. I can't see any distinction between that and Mr. Dockery's situation, where his name was on pleadings or briefs or motions, whatever.
I understood the letterhead, but maybe that's wrong.
I believe it was on the pleading, probably not pleading, because those are probably the state, but the motions and other representations.
But the point was whether it was brought to the attention of the court, and there it was, and the state said, we can't have him making an appearance. He used to be with us. And the court said, yeah, I would have him withdraw. He can't make an appearance in this case.
Can I?
Yes,
sir. You're right. It was handled in accordance with Holloway at the time the conflict was raised. Subsequently, as the case went on, evidently everybody must have overlooked the fact, they were careful that Mr. Dockery had no actual role in the court proceedings, but he did appear as the chief public defender would on the motions and whatnot submitted by the court. And at that point, it was not made known to the court, and nobody raised it until after judgment. So that's why the Seventh Circuit's decision really is on point, because there were two successive situations there.
Thank you, Ms. Flanagan. That concludes our case of State v. Love. Thank you.